You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. If you hear wolves howling tonight, you know they're joining with Lydia Yuknovich and Amber Tamblyn in Hunting the Patriarchy. One of the many themes these two spirited and non-conforming writers share in common. These two writers write about the body with easy intimacy, diving into the wound. Misfits unite, carrying life stories in their bodies. Lydia Yuknovich visits us from the beautiful, watery Pacific Northwest tonight. Amber Tamblyn flew here on a jittery plane from snowy Brooklyn, New York. Both of them join us tonight in traffic-snarled Los Angeles. Lydia Yuknovich is the best-selling author of several novels, including The Book of Joan, most recently, a provocatively reimagined Joan of Arc story set in the near future, hailed as, quote, brilliant and incendiary and unflinching by the New York Times. Other novels are The Small Backs of Children and Dora, a Headcase. She's also the author of the memoir, The Chronology of Water. And her TED Talk, The Beauty of Being a Misfit, from which we stole the title tonight, has been viewed by millions. She is a lifelong swimmer who, through her youth, claimed a sense of self, she writes, as she swam hours of laps in mornings and afternoons. Amber Tamblyn is widely known for her work as a director and actress, including her role as a modern-day Joan of Arc in the television series Joan of Arcadia. She made her directorial debut with the film Paint It Black, based on the novel by Janet Fitch. She's a native Angeleno, and we have her wonderful parents here tonight. She's been acting since childhood. She's also a lauded poet, the author of several collections, most recently Dark Sparkler, which is both memorial and a magic act, as poet Diane DePrima writes, about the inner lives of women who glimmered on screen and crashed in life. And we welcome, if I may say, in the best sense of the word, fellow misfit, Anne Friedman, a freelance journalist who writes about gender, media, technology, and culture, and who last interviewed Roxane Gay for us here at Aloud. Along with Aminato So, Anne co-hosts the Kit podcast, Call Your Girlfriend, featuring engaging dialogues on friendship, pop culture, and politics. We'll start tonight with some readings. Please welcome Amber Tamblyn, Lydia Yuknovich, and Anne Friedman. Thank you.
This is going to be the most exciting part of the evening. Are you ready? I got my Britney mic. I got my rising stage. Thank you so much for being here tonight. Thank you to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you to my fellow goddess misfit wolves. We're so excited to be here. I'm going to read two poems for you from Dark Sparkler, and then a longer new piece that's fresh out the oven. So for those of you who don't know, Dark Sparkler explores the lives and deaths of child star actresses. Some you'll know, some you don't know. The names of the actresses are the names of the poems. So mostly you won't recognize them, which is sort of the theme and the idea behind the book, which is, what do we remember, what do we not remember, what do we immortalize, what lasts in infamy, what doesn't. Lee Tobler. When you find a skull in the woods, do you leave it alone because it disturbs you, or do you leave it alone because of what's still living inside? Untitled actress. Submission calls for an actress mid to late 20s. All ethnicities acceptable, except Asian American. Caucasian preferable. Must read teen on screen. Thin but not gaunt, lean. Quirky but not unattractive. No brown eyes. Not taller than 5'5". Weight no more than 109. actress should have great smile, straight teeth a must. Must be flexible, small bust a plus. Can do own stunts, will waive rights to image, likeness, publicity, final cut. Roll calls for nudity. Roll calls for simulated sexual intercourse. Roll calls for role play with lead male. No stand-in avail. Roll pays scale. Character is shy, yet codependent, searching for love in all the wrong men. Character confides in others at her own risk. Character is fatigued, hollow, suffers from self-doubt, a sense of worthlessness. Character learns the hard way to believe in herself. No brown eyes. Character finally finds happiness when she meets Brad, a successful older businessman, 5'5". Logline. A woman fights to save her soul. Think a young Carol Lombard meets a younger Anna Nicole. Requires an actress that will leave an audience speechless. Who's found her creative voice, not a speaking role. This poem, since we're talking about wolves and the fact that a certain gentleman is here in Los Angeles this evening, felt important. This was based on a reading series I did in New York where they gave you a prompt, and the prompt was to write a letter to your childhood dream. So I went back and searched through all of my journals, which my mom and dad, who are here tonight, know I kept diligently as a kid. And growing up, and I found this quote, which should pretty much tell you everything you need to know about an 11-year-old Amber Tamblyn. Every night I have a dream that I remember the next day. Why do I have to always remember my dreams? Why can't I forget? I am secretly an animal. This much I know. I am always the same animal every night, hunting in a different darkness. That was probably fun to grow up with, don't you think? Authorities and the staff at the zoo are baffled by the animal accidentally cut completely in two at the torso, its lower half unmoved and deceased. The upper half of my body washes up on a beach right next to my mother's stolen jewelry. There you are, I whisper, my fur covered in the coffins of oysters, my fangs gnawing at the clutched cubes of rubies drizzled in the sand. I dream of wolves, I say. I will grow up to be a wolf, I dream. I will grow up to be a maze, not a labyrinth. I will grow up to be a parallel sun, shrieking fire through all the masses of masculinity. I will win all of the awards. I will grow up to be a man's wife. I will grow up to have an affair with a man's wife. I will get pregnant with her child. All the men will be so confused. It's a wolf thing, we'll say. I can breastfeed with my eyes. What the fuck can you do, men? War? Good for you and your wars. I own the moon. What the fuck do you own? I will grow up to be the ghost of Shakespeare's Cyrano, the ipso facto Plato of Plaths, the dirty arithmetic of a good old-fashioned spanking. I will grow up to be the thrush of 1,000 stars, the kaboom of kaleidoscopes headed towards your earth, a gun that shoots just the pulses that stopped the day they met you. I will grow up to be every weapon on the market, dangerous, callous, unforgiving, ruthless, ambitious, cruel, ugly on the inside and out, unladylike. I will grow up to dream like the dreams of men, to daydream of them, what they expect from wolves like me. I will dream all rivers run into my father's remaining years. He will be reborn as an ocean. My father has always howled alone, a packless beast of a king. Once I dreamed he was at the front door trying to protect me from a 20-foot-tall white buffalo with shards of glass for fur. Once he was in the subway tunnel laughing at the light headed straight for us. Once we were in a skyscraper as a wave of water bounded towards us, swallowing all the windows in tow. Please don't kill my father, I say. My father is always killed, I dream. My father howls alone. He is never a wolf. He is always a man. I am always a wolf and never his son. I will be unafraid of my father dying. I will be terrified of my life. I will be fearless when he goes. I will be scared to live on. I will grow up to be a little girl forever. I will miss my father. You will wonder why I don't really bother to mention my mother in this letter. I will address that later. Did you know I was writing a letter, dear listener? I will address that later. You probably wonder how I carry my many books, my dynamite, my threats, my swords, my venom, my brass knuckle pattern pantsuit, and all of my endangered panthers in this tiny purse. I will address that later. I will grow up to remain a little girl, I say. I grow up to remain a child, I dream. Maybe I will grow up to be alone. Maybe I will have lived the wrong life. I will have kissed too many magicless mouths. I will have not done everything I could to obtain good seats to a Beyoncé concert. I will be afraid I was never a wolf. Are you afraid you're never a wolf? Are you pulled by a darkness that quarrels between the you that is them and the you that is true? Are you or aren't you? When you grow up, will you love like the cures in his hips? Will you fuck flesh like you tear through it? When you grow up, will you stand quiet while a rotting president runs his piss through your daughter's hair? Will the white you stand quiet as the black them continue to be murdered? When you grow up, will you be complacent or complicit? Will you howl then? Will you travel in packs and feed the hungry jaws of other women like you? Will you be a better actress than all the liars that came before you? Will you return all the dresses you've stolen from the mind of the man who does not love you? Are you an object? Are you 30 years old and completely lost? Are you younger and completely lost? Are you a wise woman and completely lost? Are you completely lost with your shit together? Are you a completely lost priest or writer or veterinarian? Are you even a woman yet? Are you sure you're a wolf? Are you as scared as I am? Do you want to be loved deeper than the language of what you've earned? Do you want to be understood? Are all our mothers disappearing inside of us? Can I cry with you now? Will you think less of me? My mother is the only wolf. My mother is the only wolf. My mother is the only wolf. Through her soft jaw, I slipped into life, a puddle of marbled dreams drenching my father's hands. I am a reckoning, my mother screamed. She was reckoned, she dreams. Doctors are baffled. Authorities are baffled. The White House is baffled. The zoo staff is baffled. Donald Trump is baffled. eyewitnesses are baffled. Tom Brokaw is baffled. All your sons are baffled by the animal, cut completely in two at the torso, its lower half unmoved and deceased. The upper half of my body washes up on the beach right next to my mother's stolen jewelry. Every in darkened woman in me is either a lover or a murderer coming for you. So are you or aren't you? We own the moon. Tell us, what the fuck do you own?
Hello. Well, it works. The first thing we had to check is how bumbly I am, because I knocked my mic pack off like four times already, because I'm so good at this. You're right, it's kind of addicting. You already know what this book is about, because it was mentioned. There's a line that opens the book that is, burning is an art. And pretty much every page of the book is about a burning. Raise your hand if you've heard of Joan of Arc. You guys are suckers. I took as the premise that burning was more than we thought it was, or heard about, or mythologized, and that it could be 10,000 things. So I'm just going to read a little bit around in the beginning of the first chapter. There's a character who is safely located away from an apocalyptic Earth in a space station that kind of sucks all Earth resources away from it. And she's sort of a historian. And to give you a quick version of what she's up there doing, she's a resistance figure, and she's up there grafting, which is kind of like tattooing, except more burning. And the words or images or whatever you put on your body come out raised. She's grafting the story of Joan of Arc onto her body. And you also need to know that the people who have survived, who are up in the space station and not in the dead apocalyptic Earth, have lost all genitalia and the ability to reproduce, and hair and sweat glands, and they're just these uber white, sexless, strange creatures. So her body is more like a canvas even than those of us who have ink. Are you with me? You are a really kind audience. I pick up my electrosurgical pen. I've become accustomed to not flinching, not grimacing, not displaying any physical response to the strange pain of it. What is pain compared to the cessation of someone's life story? This is a more precise form of scarification than tattooing ever was, because it allows the artist to control the depth and nature of the damage being done to the skin. With traditional direct branding, heat is transferred to the tissues surrounding the brand, burning and damaging them. Electrosurgical branding, in contrast, vaporizes the skin so quickly and precisely that it creates little to no damage to the surrounding skin. You see? One might make a text. The skin near my collarbone screams, tiny red and hieroglyphics speckle my chest. In a few hours, I will have completed a first stanza across the canvas of my breastplate. I'm no longer sure exactly what the word pain means. I left it long ago in favor of story. Everything in life has more than one story layer, like skin does, epidermis, dermis, subcutaneous, and hypodermis. My history has a subtext. I first attracted the attention in CL, which is the place she lives in the space station, when I questioned the literary merit of the most famous, highly regarded author of narrative skin grafts, our now dictatorial leader, Jean de Men. I dedicate the rest of this segment to a person across the street from us. Jean de Men, that's his actual name. I always found that name stupid and hilarious. John of Men. He wrote what was considered the most famous CL narrative graft of our time, which somehow became hailed by consensus as the greatest text of all human history, as if time worked that way, as if Earth's history had everything in it, had evaporated before us until it was just John, the man, his famous text, the world. My room ignites with the holographic memory of him, fragments of his evolution. It's a perfect and terrifying consumer culture story. Really, listen to this. His early life as a self-help guru and reality TV star. His astral rise as an author revered by millions worldwide, then overtaking television, that puny propaganda device on Earth, and finally, the seemingly unthinkable, as media became a manifested room in your home. He overtook all of our lives, his performances increasingly more violent in form. His is a journey from opportunistic showman to worship celebrity to billionaire to fascistic power monger. I mean, the only part I missed is that it was orange. What was left when the wars broke out, his transformation to sadistic military leader was the punctuation mark. We are what happens when the seemingly unthinkable celebrity rises beyond power. Our existence makes my eyes hurt. People are forever thinking that the unthinkable can't happen. If it doesn't exist in thought, then it can't exist in life. And then, in the blink of an eye, in a moment of danger, a figure who takes power from our weak desires and failures emerges like a rib from sand. Jean de Men, some strange combination of a military dictator and a spiritual charlatan, a war-hungry mountebank. How stupidly we believe in our petty evolutions. Yet another case of something shiny that entertained us and then devoured us. We consume and become exactly what we create in all times. My chest screams back at me. This stanza on my body needs to heal before I can continue with the graft. Again, I apply a mild astringent, the sting, brief like whisper. I blow air on my own chest. In the mirror, everything on my body is red and swollen and illegible, but words are coming. Soon there will be raised skin words, whiter than white, replacing all trace of breast and that thing we used to call woman. I'm old enough to have read books, seen films, studied art and history. I smile. I remember everything. Yet that story of a girl warrior killed on the cusp of her womanhood, and what happened after it. It tilted the world on its axis, tilted the lives of those on Earth, which glides still below us, tilted the lives of the whitened bodies dying out above. We've made pathetic angels up here surviving. But not all legend becomes history, and not all literature deserves to become legend. In the dim light of this idiotic living in a space station, in this last year of my life, I feel the skin between my shoulders ache from my neck to the bottom of my rib cage. It reddens and swells. I stare at my torso in the mirror, and it almost seems to pulse, to be burned alive with meaning, to have her story bring me back to life on my actual skin, the opposite of Joan's death. A fire to replace what used to burn between our legs. But I already know the endgame of the battle I am waging. I already know what I want. I want her story back. I want to use my body to get it. Thanks.
Thanks, both of you. I don't even know where to start. I was actually going to bring up, I'm glad that you read it in the context of that first chapter, but I was going to bring up that quote, "We consume and become exactly what we create in all times." Because I, like a lot of people, read this book in the midst of this presidency, like all people, probably many people. And I'm curious about whether you could talk a bit more about that line, what it means beyond the context of your character here.
I have to be careful because I'm probably the most cynical person in the room, and that's such a buzzkill if I answer questions too authentically.
You could answer as a wolf.
Even better. I think the thing that interests me is in so many ways we're all just crushed that this thing happened to us politically. And the cynical part of me is like, and this is exactly what we set ourselves up for in terms of the runaway consumerism and celebrity culture. And so that's where my cynicism comes in, that we are the thing we hate. We made it. And I don't mean necessarily Amber personally made it, or you, Anne, made it, or anyone in the audience. You all look beautiful to me. It wasn't exactly you, and yet it was us. In that Shakespeare, this thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine. We made the conditions under which something happened that we now hate. And so the only place to look is us.
And do you think, I mean, the theme of our evening, and this is a question for both of you, I mean, is nonconformity. Do you think that's true of even those of us who would like to believe that we're not participating in that, or who are consuming things that we think are, you know, a value of art, of a higher or better mind? I don't know.
I think it's really hard not to participate in some level. I think even by being on social media, we're participating. I think about that constantly whenever I'm like on a high horse talking about something that I feel like should be talked about. And I'm like, but look at the platform I'm choosing to use, and what good does this really do ultimately? So I think that I feel like we're like in some form of the dark ages right now, of a new dark age, which is scary, but...
More cynical than I am.
Yeah. I know, I was like, you're the depressing one?
Just wait for the famine, it's coming. The good news is that there is always light at the end of that in some form. There has to be. I mean, we've survived this long, so... It's just a guy with a comb over. It's not a big deal. It's going to be okay. That's the way I feel.
Okay, let me phrase this a different way. And you can answer this in terms of your writing or in terms of your participation in this world as a human, whatever. I know you both participate in this world as writers, so it's a bit of a trick question. But do you think that you can cultivate that nonconformist impulse to kind of say, okay, I'm participating in social media, even though I recognize it's bad, and I'm going to like choose to do things another way? Or like as a writer, I'm going to choose a certain path or be drawn towards certain impulses?
I think as human mammals, we F it up all the time. Mm-hmm. I think it can exist briefly and beautifully and terribly inside things like art that we make, or spaces, liminal spaces we open up to rub against the grain of the status quo or what's happening. But I think as humans, we participate on something called Facebook. And then we act like, no big deal. Yeah. It's called Facebook. There's no getting out of, like, you're not the outsider if you're participating on Facebook. Or even if you're not participating, you're still not the outsider. So I think it's kind of a human mammal failing that we can never quite get outside it completely. But I think instances like art or resistance or little high schoolers in Florida are instances of, you know, the cry that is not consumed by the thing we're trying to fight.
By the Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. The Facebook.
By the Facebook.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have a very popular TED Talk about what it means to be a misfit. And maybe you can talk a bit about how you define that term and you know, what it means in the context of this conversation, too.
Do you identify with that word, misfit?
I Not particularly. I wonder if it's like, if it's a generational word, but I do you use it. So I identify it. I mean, because you're cool as shit to me. So you're like the coolest. So any word that you use eventually sort of feels like it becomes like a really important, valuable sentiment. And I think maybe it's just that I'd never really thought about the word before. I'd never really considered it and what it actually means as far as like its literal definition too. And the fact that you're not fitting, you're missing the fit. And there's something to be said about that. And I've certainly, I think in the last 2 years, I've said this before, but being pregnant during this election was one of the most dissociative experiences that I'd ever had. And I felt like it was out of body experience almost. And after the election had given birth and after I had given birth, I felt radicalized in a way that I'd never felt before. And so then that word actually sort of, because I remember that's when you were writing a lot about it. And I was like, oh, that word, for the first time ever, I understand what that means.
I don't even fully identify with it. I mean, it came out of a TED Talk thing that nearly killed me because...
Why?
Because I'm not that.
Oh, I understand. Okay, I understand. Yes.
And at every second of delivering it on a stage, I was pretty sure I was going to die, literally. And I was waiting for Andy to come and collect me off the stage. And I have told other people, back to a theme we talked about at dinner, I was also having a period that was tantamount to the Red Sea. So I also thought I was going to bleed out on stage during the TED Talk, which was pretty spectacular.
That's one way to go.
I would have clicked that very fast.
Yes.
Like, I would have watched that faster than most TED Talks.
So I would not be taking your advice from backstage.
We had a long conversation about period underwear backstage.
We did.
As well. Yeah.
I learned so much.
Yeah.
But the word came to me from that talk. And then the book offer came to me from that talk.
Oh, wow, okay.
And so I had to think about what the etymology of the word was for me personally. And it wasn't a category of outsider cool.
Mm-hmm.
It was some of us just missed and continue to miss. And yet we're highly functional socially. We get jobs. We have relationships. Good and bad things happen to us. But this business of missing the story or missing the place to put your foot or dismantling your mic pack like four times, I think is another liminal space where people's authentic potential kind of rises up, different than who we are as consumers.
Right. But it seems like that's where most good writing comes up from as well. I mean, the sense of something doesn't fit or something needs to be made sense of or I don't understand something.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that idea a lot.
Yeah. I thought you were going to be like, oh, and here's a time when I...
No, I just, I'm admiring you.
I mean, well, I feel like I took that idea from your book. I mean, the idea that like it requires a bit of a shift in perspective sometimes to get at a bigger or deeper truth. I mean, you both do that in your work.
It's also, I think it's not a choice. Like it's not this is such an interesting definition or understanding of the word, interpretation of that word in particular. And for me, I always knew that poetry was not a choice. It was not like an actor who like picked a hobby to put out a Christmas album or something. That's what people do, right? I don't know. it was never a choice. It always felt like a form of survival at a certain stake. While that might sound dramatic, like being a child actor, you know, required that while I was playing many different objects and people at any given time and had a phenomenal upbringing and really amazing parents, there's still this sense of being othered from myself. And so poetry felt like a form of survival, being able to tap into a part of my psyche and myself. And so I think by nature, that survival and writing from places where I feel like, you know, if I don't say this, there's part of me that's not going to survive,
is part of like my misfit journey in that way. That's how I relate to the word.
Do you have that feeling as well? If I don't say this, I might die.
I have the feeling if I don't keep writing, I turn into a crazy woman, and I have evidence that is true. And some of us have a tenuous enough hold on the planet and existence in the first place that if we don't do something with our hands, bad things.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that.
If that's similar, then yes.
I think it is, right? I mean... I don't know. That I there's a part of me that's like, that's how you can tell you're a true artist, when you're like, I have to. Like,
oh.
I have to. There is something that is bigger and deeper than compensation or social pressure or reward.
I hear you.
I don't know. You seem to both have it.
There's been a lot for me over the last several months, especially with everything that's going on in what I'm calling the new women's revolution right now, but there was many times where I've gone, am I going to never work again because of this? Because of what I'm saying or what I'm, you know, how I feel about things. And that's just, that's an example of like, oh, well, that's the way it is. And there's not a choice. There's not a choice to sort of be quiet about certain things. And especially in writing and work, I've found like in the last year or two of just... a lot of change in my ability to write and also verbalize my anger and not feel... I've always been great at that and also enjoyed it and felt like that was a real outlet for me. But certainly in the last 2 years, I feel like things have really, really changed. And I've felt much more connected to my rage space and more nurturing of it and allowing it to take its course in order to say what I feel, ultimately.
Hmm. Has it changed your writing, your work?
I think so, but I think also writing has changed my writing. I think just being present and figuring out, you know, what my voice is and having, you know, I've had so many wonderful mentors growing up and finding out that I wasn't supposed to write like any of them, which is, I think, what we all ultimately find out is as our voice matures and you start to find out what you want and who you truly are. And I think, again, I keep going back to this election because it just felt like such a catalyst for me. It felt like my voice had been heading somewhere for a while. Like, this book was published in 2015. But ultimately, I think what's gone on over the last 2 years was kind of like this... intensified catapult that just sent me and every other woman I know into this radicalization mode. And and I think maybe I write freer now because of that, frankly. I think maybe before I was just kind of sort of stumbling over what I thought I was compared to what I was supposed to be. Again, which, you know, if you grow up auditioning, if you grow up acting all the time, you really only know how to walk into someone else's room, and predominantly men, and, you know, have them say yes or no to you, i.e. giving you a job. And so much of that has shifted and changed. And naturally, I think this like deep thorn of a voice that's always been there for me as a writer, finally just sort of like bloomed very quickly and very forcefully.
Yeah, but it was clearly there. I mean, the poem that's near the end of Dark Sparkler, where you're basically like telling everyone in Congress to go fuck themselves, is like, I could have used that as a script for calling myself, right? Like, it was there. It was definitely like this was all present before, you know, this country elected Trump. Right.
Yeah, it was. Maybe it's just the election then that, for at least for me, felt it solidified it. Mm-hmm. Or it made me go, because, you know, there's always this sense, you know, for me, there was always a sense of second guessing and questioning and wondering if what I was doing was right, if I was going down the right path, if I was, you know, just general questioning. Mm-hmm. And I think this really solidified a lot of the feelings that I had about not only what was going on in the world and what seemed to be particularly unfair in my industry, but also that I was right, or that my voice is right and necessary, and to not shy away from that anymore.
Right. Yeah. And what about you, Lydia? I mean, I know particularly the passage that you read tonight feels so on the nose for Great. You know, and is this something that had been percolating for a long time before current events transpired?
Oh, yeah. I was writing about those themes and characters and issues 3 years before the current debacle. And I wasn't sitting around thinking about Trump. I was just thinking about some monstrous celebrity figure that we created in our own image.
That's crazy.
Took over the world. And wouldn't that be terrible? So it was completely bizarro to me that the way things played out. But I also, a thing that's sort of amazing about our current moment is that the cracks and fissures and plate tectonics going on help us see differently that the things we're upset about have been going on since the dawn of mammals. And that, I mean, there are days where I wake up and I remember, yeah, like how America stole everything from indigenous people. It's like a really old story, not a new story that's just happening right now. Or, you know, how our country is founded on the backs of slave labor, and that was called an economy. And it lets us open our eyes again and again to very old stories. And so, for my own part, when anything I write enters a stream that has anything to do with anyone else, it's always exciting. I'm not alone in a room in my underwear, just talking to myself. So
in
I'm
your
always,
period underwear. Yeah, I get
period
it.
Underwear.
I get it.
So it's exciting that even one person knows what I'm talking about. But when any writer, when their storytelling enters the stream of bigger storytelling that's bigger than me or bigger than Amber and reminds us that there was storytelling before we were born and it'll be there after we die, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. That's where the potential is, not any one person's work.
Right. One thing I think you're both so good at is taking a really established narrative. What does it mean? What does a love story mean? Or like in Paint It Black, like what are the stages of grieving? You know, things like that. And just like messing with that in the best way and getting the reader or the viewer to reconsider what it means to tell that, what it means to tell a grieving story, or what it means to tell a love story, and it might not be possible to summarize for us here or to talk about it. But I'm curious about whether that is a conscious choice, if that's like a thing you see and set out to do, or if it's something that happens more naturally as you think about stories you want to tell.
For me, I think it's just the lifelong lived of a poet, of being a poet, meaning, boy, that was not English at all. meaning I've been a poet as long as I've been an actress. So for, you know, over two decades since I was a kid, and I see the world in that way. I see things, through a poetic lens, a real poetic lens, and filmmaking for me and making that story was, you know, Paint It Black is a novel written by Janet Fitch, which I adapted to a feature film, which is now on Netflix. And for me, it was so much in that example of saying, how can I make a film that isn't the adaptation of the literal book, but that is a film that will make the audience and the people that watch it feel like what they felt like when they were reading the book? That's the harder work to do, is to convey a sentiment that's not through expository dialogue or particularly language, but if it's through language, it makes you feel something that, like you said, might be a common theme, but you're feeling it for the first time in a different way. And I know that it was my background with poetry that really helped me find that in an editing room for that film.
You can see it in the film. Mm. You can see the film poem in it.
Yeah.
In the movie.
A film poem. I like that. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm gonna call it from now on. Yeah.
I set out with a really not very ambitious idea at all, which was how could I deconstruct the war story, the love story, and the God story?
My God, yeah.
I love this.
Because I think the three of those make an impossible helix that has ruined us. Our not inability to pull those three stories apart from each other, in my personal opinion, has sent us down a road to ruin. And I think this story, I'm not dissing myself when I say this, so don't make the sad Lydia noise. I think the story failed, but I'm really proud of myself for having an idea that was bigger than me and reaching for it. And I'd rather fail at something bigger than me that was so exciting I thought I might die trying to make a piece of art than wildly succeed at a simple story that made everybody eat popcorn.
I hear
that. So I feel it's a kind of fail. It's a beautiful failure. It's like the, you know, fail better. Yeah.
That is the best version of like the bad Instagram quote version of that is like reach for the stars. Yeah. Even if you fail, you know, it's like that is so much better.
Oh, that's my favorite.
Okay, I'm going to ask you another question, but I just want everyone to start thinking of your questions because you will have a chance imminently. So both of you are mothers. Both of you are partnered with men. Like, all of us sitting up here, like, have lots and lots of privilege in this world in a lot of different ways. I'm curious about the idea of nonconformity or like, kind of, like, coming in from the outside at a lot of ideas, like, given your, like, political and social place in the world and, like, how you think about that.
Mm. So this won't make any sense at all, and we can move quickly to Amber. I think gender is a hoax. I think heterosexuality is a house we stay safe in. And I think people read me incorrectly all the time.
Yes, you may. I agree.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I keep going back to, I feel... I'm 34. I know I'm still young, and I feel like terrible that it's taken me this long to see so many of the things that have sort of been there in front of my face this whole time when we're talking about the history and we're talking about the world we live in and what it was founded on and, you know, how it was built and created and taking so long to sort of, even just as a writer in even my 20s and trying to formulate my own voice, in taking a longer time, I feel like, than necessary, which is why I feel like I'm writing at an exponential speed right now. It's truly insane. I finished a novel, and I'm working on another book, and I feel this, like vomiting of important work. It feels important to me. Am I answering your question? I don't even know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but can I have some of your vomit?
Yes. Yeah. Backstage. It's going to get weird. I'm into it. Anyway, I vomit great work. That's the statement that I was trying to make.
Yeah.
in some form.
Wait, are you in a vomit stage right now as well?
I am not so much in a vomit stage, though I have at other times been in a vomit stage, and I am creeping up on a vomit stage.
Sure.
Creeping up on a vomit stage.
Thank you, disgusted audience member. This was a night of nonconformity, okay? Like, does anyone have a question you want to ask? I think that there are some microphones that will be coming around. They're in the back. We can keep going up here if no one has a question.
We can sit here all night. We'll just wait you out.
Yeah.
There's somebody.
Hi. This question is for Lydia. You're saying that you felt that you failed at cracking the war story, the love story, and the God story, which I disagree because you're brilliant. However, I'm wondering, as a storyteller, if you're looking to tackle those again and to try and succeed this time in your mind, and what to you the world would look like beyond those stories.
Oh. So somebody I love died recently who was named Ursula Le Guin. It would look a little bit like an Ursula Le Guin novel to start with the last part of your question. And I hope people only ever read one book of mine in their lifetimes or they'll catch on. I just write about the same things over and over and over again with different settings. That's not really true, but a little bit it's true. I've got my sights on deconstructing nations. And what the question Joan ends with, for me, probably no one else sees this or cares, is what if we loved the planet the way we claim we love lovers and children and spouses and the people we love the most in our lives, what if we transferred that devotion to all being and all existence and our place in the cosmos? Now I just sound crazy. And I would like to use that as a jumping off point. And so that could get weird. But I am starting with the end of nations as the starting ground and a statue and some workers. That's all I'm telling you. And my idea is way bigger than me. Like, there's no way. It's going to be a miserable failure. And I can't wait to, like, jump. So see you in, like, 2 years.
Thank you. Amber, you briefly referenced Time's Up. I wonder if there is a plan of evolution, of where it's going to go, what's going to be the next step, and what is going to be the ultimate goal?
Well, there's always an ultimate goal for such a large movement like Time's Up. We're very much focused on ending workplace discrimination and harassment across all industries. It is a massive, massive, massive undertaking and wish. And I think we realize we can't do everything all at once and that we need everyone to be a part of that movement, including men. We really need men to step up and be allies to women. This is something we've talked about before, but we really need men to stop telling us how and when to share our stories, to stop telling us what their consequences should be for bad behavior. We don't need any of that. We just need men to be quiet, to listen, to let us figure out what we need for our own safety and for our bodies in the workplace. And then we need them to support that decision and to stand behind it and help amplify it. And there are so many different ways in which that can be done. One of the largest issues I think that we face, that we work on within Time's Up, is pay inequality across industries. One of the best things men can do is be transparent about how much they make. If there's a woman that you're working with who's in the same field as you, the same job description, doing the same work as you, tell her how much money you make. And likely, there's a really, really strong chance that you are making more than she is, and you should go out of your way to try to help correct that in every way possible. So really, it's about sort of, we look at how we can be most effective. You know, the movement's only about 3 months old. It's very new, and so much of it has to do with changing the power dynamic. And that's going to take a long time and steady focus, which I think so much of the work that we all do is part of that. I mean, even just as writers, you don't have to be, you know, a part of any particular movement to say, like, you're doing the work of Time's Up. You're doing the work of Me Too. You're doing those works. So it's about amplification and the hard work and also strong allyship from men. The end. Is that over here?
Two Brooklyn Angelino girls here.
Nice.
I'm just curious how you ended up in Brooklyn.
How I ended up in Brooklyn?
Didn't you grow up here?
I did, yeah. I was born and raised here. And I moved to Brooklyn. I moved to New York 10 years ago. I was shooting a TV show there. And then and my husband, my then boyfriend, lived out there. And that was that. Bob's your uncle, as they say in the UK. What a strange sentence that is. Yeah. And yeah, so that's it, and then and that's where I live. I love it.
Question over here?
Yeah, thanks.
My question is more about this idea of nonconformity and if that's really the question we should be asking. I think that a lot of people just want the easy answer. So I think if we say nonconformity, then everyone's going to be like, I'm just going to argue about everything. I think is that really the question, or is it more just like think critically, right? And how do we start asking those questions, and how do we encourage that and also open dialogue, right? I think there's this constant knee-jerk reaction about like, always just shutting down everything we're told, like, if you think this way, I don't want to hear it. And so I guess my question is more like, how do you seek in your work to help people understand how to have those conversations, how to work through those moments of disagreement, and how to start getting people to think critically again? Because that's where I think the real struggle is.
I so agree with you and hear you. And part of the life labor for me in the world is I work at correctional facilities and rehab centers and with introverts and people who are coming from places of trauma. And I already know they're my tribe. I am of those peoples. And part of the work for me, part of the labor is to get more voices, the voices that are disappeared or told they're doing it wrong. I mean, even the misfit liminal space I was trying to open up has, in that book, it has 9 other people with 9 other stories and bodies in it that I had to fight the TED folk about. Because they just wanted Lydia to blather on for 200 pages about misfittery, the outsider role. And I said, what if we open space for a myriad of voices, the multi-voice? And so some of the deep work for me is digging to bring to the surface those voices that are discounted, erased, made invisible, so that we can enter the critical space and form critical mass with voices ordinarily completely ignored, or shut away, or imprisoned, or living under an overpass. So that's my orientation to your question. There's a gazillion ways to answer it, but that's my orientation. So I agree, it's labor. It's our labor. That's what we should be doing. Not going, yay, misfit. But I have a Misfits band t-shirt. I mean, it's so cool. But, I mean, I agree. That's the work.
Hi. I was curious, who are the writers of color whose work you were either influenced by or want to amplify?
I always go to poetry. It's primarily what I read. I don't read a lot of fiction, so there's many. I will start by saying Patricia Smith. I think is probably one of the most important poets living today. I love Claudia Rankine. I love a poet named Morgan Parker. Those are the 3 off the top of my head. Rachel McKibbins, phenomenal poet, Chicana poet out of Rochester, New York. She has a book that came out a couple months ago called Blood that I think is probably one of the most incredible books. Roxane Gay just gave it like 5 out of 5 stars on Goodreads. And she's one of the most important living poets. Really amazing. There's a couple.
I'll just talk about this book to make it concise, but I had a big old picture of Octavia Butler and Leslie Marmon-Silko like mothers over my head. And frankly, the least interesting writing going on today for me personally is from white women, but that's sort of a terrible thing to say, so pretend I didn't say it. Okay.
Okay, sorry, this is our last question. I'm just listening.
It's for you.
The end of the patriarchy. I invite your scenario, timeline, thoughts about that. Celebration.
you just got a slow head turn.
My answers have to do with however much longer I live, who knows, right? None of us know, right? I hope that all my art is exploring those kinds of questions. I don't have a concise analysis answer for that. It seems to be breaking down, and let's celebrate, because whatever's next is, you know, means there was the possibility of change, mm-hmm. and ground turning over, and revolution in the best sense, that change was possible, is the most hopeful sentence a person can make on the planet. That we could say, as mammals, change is possible, whether you're pro-patriarchy or against patriarchy or where you are in the fight, that change is possible is the definition of hope from the ground up.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think we all sort of suffer from forms of being part of a patriarchal society, men, women, all of us together, and so it's a long, long road, long collective effort. But I feel, at least for me in this space of living, I feel like alive with the knowledge of it, and the conversations to me are the largest part of the beginning of any real reception and change. So hopefully we're at some new frontier of it, and it doesn't and Donald Trump doesn't get elected again in 2 years. That's really the other that's the other part of it.
Oh my God, on that excellent note, thanks to both of you so much for being here.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you very much.
For all of you, Amber and Lydia will be out this direction, signing books out that way, meeting you, answering your further questions about patriarchy. Go meet them there. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.